From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. In a moment, storms from the sun, followed by evil. Here's what's happening. Well, the recent West Nile virus outbreak, still now called the largest ever seen in the United States, according to new numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The number of cases so far this year, the highest recorded through August since this disease was first detected in the United States in 1999. As of August 21st, 38 states had reported human infections. The cases reported to the CDC total 1,118, including 41 deaths. Dr. Robin Falco, we're turning to her right now for a couple questions. One, Robin, first of all, they say that 41 people have died from the West Nile virus. What do you think? How many people do you think have died from just the what I call the seasonal flu?
Sure. Excuse me, George. What everyone has to keep in mind that there are many people who are immune compromised. That means they might be fighting severe viral conditions, leukemia, cancer, other conditions that compromise their body's ability to, you know, bring about a really strong defense when they're exposed. So I don't know about the claims of 41 deaths being specifically from that. It could be that the people were not well to begin with. Mm-hmm. They had, you know, extenuating health conditions that contributed. But, you know, we're looking at something that 20% of the people will present with symptoms and 80% will have none.
None at all.
Right, and some of these symptoms can be swollen lymph glands, stiff neck, occasionally a rash on the trunk. And what's confusing is that these symptoms can appear within 2 to 15 days and disappear in a few days. Now, what's really concerning is when someone will have a high fever with a severe headache that lasts. And I have to say, the CDC claims that there is no treatment for this. Homeopath, I'm a homeopathic physician. The beauty of our approach is that we are treating the symptoms, not a label.
That's right.
So when somebody comes in and they tell us what's wrong with them, then we can treat that, and lo and behold, the patient gets better. So there's really a lot to do, and there's a lot of mixed feeling about the origins of the whole West Nile virus to begin with. You know, there are a lot of claims about that it was another one that was created. I don't have an answer yes or no about that. But I do urge people, you know, especially in the main states that are affected, which are Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, South Dakota, and Oklahoma, to just, you know, pay attention to what the worst case scenario would be and to keep in mind that there are treatments, there are things that can help that won't have severe side effects. Patient gets better. You know, you're familiar with all this stuff, George.
You got that right. Robin, thank you so much. We'll continue to check in with you on this situation. Like she said, 80% of the people who get bitten by a mosquito that had West Nile virus don't get sick at all. Actress Natalie Wood's death certificate has been amended to reflect some of the lingering questions surrounding the star's death in 1981. Wood drowned during a boat trip with her husband, television star Robert Wagner, and actor Christopher Walken. At the time, it was ruled to have been an accident, but police reopened their inquiry late last year after receiving new evidence. The death certificate now says she died as a result of drowning and other undetermined factors. The bat and the company Louisville Slugger in the Little League Baseball will pay a New Jersey boy $14.5 million to settle a lawsuit after he was left brain damaged. He was struck in the chest by a line drive that stopped his heart while he was playing in a youth baseball game in 2006. He's 18 years old now. Well, the drums of war continue to beat. Iran's supreme leader has ordered the country's Revolutionary Guards to intensify its campaign of terror attacks against the West and its allies in retaliation for supporting the overthrow of President Assad in Syria. So we'll continue to monitor this situation. I still predict things are getting very tense. I talked to a friend of mine. He's from Iran. He said, no way. This is just rhetoric. They've been saying this for years, yet I've talked to others, and they think it's a little more serious than that. Americans are throwing out nearly every other bite of food, wasting up to 40% of the country's supply each year. A mass of uneaten provisions worth $165 billion. Family of four squanders $2,275 in food every year. Americans bought more homes in July than in June. The latest evidence that the housing market is slowly, but they say steadily improving. Sales of previously occupied homes rose to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 4.47 million in July. Catherine Austin Fitz with us. Catherine, is this a false bump? What do you think?
I think it's too early. I think we need confirmation. If you look at how all the markets have been trading, the precious metals market, commodities, the stock market, since 2008, George, we've seen asset values very much reflect monetary policy. And if you look at how much, for example, the S&P is up 10% this year, mm-hmm. if you look at how much the commodities markets or the stock markets are trading this up this year in a way that reflects monetary policy, it says to me is housing is behind. So I think this is a little bit early, and I think we need to see confirmation by continued rise in prices and activity in the fall. That'll be the test.
Catherine's website, Solari.com, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. NASA's Curiosity rover has finally begun to roll on the red planet. The Mars robot, which landed on the red planet 2 weeks ago, turned its six wheels briefly to satisfy engineers that its locomotion system was in full working order. They're ready to turn that thing loose. With no strong flares for more than 48 hours, the sun's X-ray output has nearly flatlined so far. They say solar activity is low. And, you know, tonight on Coast to Coast, we will discuss how the sun will reach its peak in its 10-year activity cycle, how it could cause X flares and other solar storms, with our very special guest, Ramon Lopez. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Ramon Lopez, co-author of Storms from the Sun, explores the emerging physical science of space weather, tracing it and its impact on a society that relies, and we really do, on space-based technologies. Dr. Lopez, currently professor of physics at the University of Texas at Arlington, co-director of the Center for Integrated Space Weather Modeling. He has received his bachelor's degree in physics from the University of Illinois, PhD in space physics from Rice University, and here he is on Coast to Coast, Ramon Lopez. Doctor, how are you?
I'm George. How are you doing?
Good. Looking forward to talking with you about this tonight. You know, every time I monitor space weather websites and check into solar storms, we hear, you know, the sun's activity, sunspots, X-flare, we lucked out, it didn't hit us or it wasn't big enough. Don't you think, Doctor, it's just a matter of time that we're going to get hit with one of these huge solar storms?
Well, sure. Like so many other things, it's only a matter of time, you know. It's only a matter of time before we have a big earthquake.
Yep.
It's only a matter of time before we have a big hurricane. And so that's why preparation and prediction is important.
Let's talk a little bit about space weather. I think it's an emerging field. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, space weather refers to changes in the space environment. Just like here on Earth, we talk about terrestrial weather in the context of changes in the environment on Earth. I used to live in Florida on the Atlantic coast. And a nice day, you'd have a nice little sea breeze at 10 miles an hour. But if the wind was 100 miles an hour, that's a Category 1 hurricane. So that's a factor of 10 difference in the wind speed. In space, things like the radiation levels can change by a factor of 10,000. So you've got really large variability in the environmental characteristics of the space environment. And it's those changes that we call space weather.
It generally, is the temperature of the sun that reaches us, is it pretty constant?
Yeah, the sun, if you look at it, it's this glowing yellow ball, and if you look at the light that's coming from the sun and analyze it, it looks like it's what we call a black body, just something that's radiating at a temperature of about 6,000 degrees. But that's really deceptive because actually the atmosphere of the sun is about 1,000,000 degrees. And in the 40s, when this was discovered, it was a great surprise. How could you have something that looks like it surface temperature is 6,000 degrees with such a hot atmosphere. And that's because the solar magnetic field is involved in transferring energy. The energy of the boiling and the churning and the roiling of the material in the sun, that mechanical energy gets transferred by the magnetic field as it gets twisted up into electrical energy that heats the upper atmosphere to this million degrees. And then that upper atmosphere is so hot, the sun's gravity can't hold it down, and it just expands out through space, accelerating as it goes, and becomes what we call the solar wind. So the solar wind is always there. It's always blowing past us. And at the Earth's location, the temperature of the solar wind is typically about 50,000 degrees Celsius. Now, that sounds like a really hot temperature,
sure,
large number, but, you know, it's very, very thin. It's only a few particles per centimeter. So, you know, if something is, the gases in space can be very, very hot, but if it's also, by our standards, essentially a vacuum, then you're not going to get a lot of heat by being exposed to that.
You know, Doctor, our margin of comfort is so narrow. I mean, if it gets a little too hot, we're uncomfortable. If it gets a little too cold, we're uncomfortable. There's that little window there, isn't there?
That's right. And the Earth is in that Goldilocks zone where it's not too hot, it's not too cold, just right.
Unless you're in St. Louis for 6 weeks at 105.
Right. I'm here in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Summer, boy.
Same thing.
Fortune.
Same thing. I just had that story of the West Nile virus out there. Are people panicking there over this?
Yeah. In fact, my wife just was telling me today, hey, you know what's going on around here?
Well, the only good thing about that, 80% of the people who get bitten by these mosquitoes don't even get sick. So that's a good sign. What's new in space weather technology that could give us more information?
Well, what's been the big story of the past few years is our increasing ability to predict. And the National Weather Service, which predicts all kinds of other weather, several years ago moved space weather from its research arm into the National Weather Service. So there's, just like you got the severe storm labs in Oklahoma or the Hurricane Prediction Center in Miami, Florida, there's now the Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado. And scientific models have been developed that are being transitioned to operation at the Space Weather Prediction Center. So our predictions are getting, you know, bit by bit better and better of what's coming from the sun, if what we see from the sun is it actually going to hit the Earth. And eventually we'll get to the point where we can have pretty good predictions of what will be the impact on our local space weather and our technology.
How much leeway will we have when we get the predictions down?
Well, right now, part of the issue is that we can't really do a good job of predicting what exactly the sun is going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And doing those calculations and transferring them from the sun to the Earth is pretty problematic. So we use a satellite that's out in space about a million miles away from the Earth to get our really detailed local prediction.
That's the SOHO, right?
ACE actually is in that same orbit. And it's usually the ACE data that we use, Advanced Composition Explorer. That gives us a one-hour lead time for really kind of detailed prediction.
Boy, that's not much time, is it?
No, it's not. Now, if there's a really big thing that blows off from the sun, then you got a few days. So you can say, well, we have a pretty good idea that this is going to hit us, but you don't know exactly what it's going to do.
When an X flare does burst from the sun, why does it take, in my mind, it takes long to get here? Why isn't it instant, like at the speed of light?
Well, part of it is.
Okay.
So the X-rays that come from the X-class flare, they come at the speed of light. So it's 8 minutes from the sun to the Earth. And there are some prompt effects of that. You can get some radio blackouts, because those X-rays can ionize the ionosphere or add to the ionization of the ionosphere and cause radio problems. As in fact, your intro talked about that you can have space weather impact radio transmission.
Mm-hmm.
That happens right away.
Okay.
And then very high-energy particles that are accelerated in interplanetary space by the explosion, they'll arrive within, you know, an hour or something like that. And so we can have some idea that those things are coming, you know, from you actually see the X-rays. And then there's the slower solar wind. Sometimes these flares are associated with large eruptions of material that we call coronal mass ejections, CMEs. And those might take, you know, 2 or 3 days to get to us because they're traveling at a much slower speed. And those are the things that produce magnetic storms.
What determines the strength of those solar flares, whether it's an M or a C or an X? What determines that?
Well, those labels M, C, and X depend on how much energy is released. And how much energy is released depends on the magnetic field in whatever goes off. But these are really big questions. We don't really know exactly when is something going to go off or exactly how much energy is going to be released. We get some ideas. You know, you see the magnetic field bend into a little S-shaped kind of curve. You have a good idea that in the next day or so something might happen. But the details of that are actively being studied now. What is it that triggers a flare? And can we make observations ahead of time that will give us a good idea of how big that flare will be?
In the 1800s, a big one must have hit us because the telegraph system went down. And I'm not sure the people of that day, Doctor, even knew what was going on.
No, they had no idea. I mean, can you imagine? Aurora was seen down in Havana, Cuba, and off the coast of Nicaragua during that huge magnetic storm. And that's the one that actually people talk about today as an example of a superstorm. And, you know, there was a report in 2008, National Research Council, that examined what might be the effect on our technology today if one of those kinds of things were to happen. These kinds of super magnetic storms have been going on throughout history.
Oh, sure.
Impacted us because we didn't care.
No, we didn't have to rely that much. We didn't have satellites or anything.
We didn't have that technology. But, you know, in 1859, they had the telegraph, which was the internet of its day. And that telegraph was knocked out for a week.
What size flare would have to hit us on a direct shot to the planet in order to take out the grid, the power grid?
Well, again, it's not so much the flare. The flare is the prompt release of energy right at the sun. Sometimes these things launch huge clouds, and then these clouds come and hit us. And the fastest cloud that we know of traveled about 19 hours from sun to earth. And there's some reason to believe that might be the fastest speed these things can go. So if we had one of these Carrington-like events, the one that happened in 1859, named after the British astronomer Carrington, who actually observed, he was drawing sunspots when the flare went off. He was really surprised. Like, they're like a light coming in my room somewhere. And he checked the room and no, it wasn't like a stray beam of light. It was actually something happening on the sun. So that event in 1859 is our template. You know, on the order of 18 to 20 hours to get from sun to earth. And that thing produced a magnetic storm that's far more intense than anything that we've seen in historical times. And this report in 2008 from the National Research Council pointed out that if we had such a storm today, there could be really significant and long-lasting effects to the U.S. economy if we were not prepared to deal with it.
I mean, it could be months, I think, if the right size CME hit us.
That's right. The issue is that if you have one of these superstorms, there's so much electric current generated in the ground of the Earth, actually, that it'll get into our power grid and it blows transformers. Now, this has happened before. It happened in March of 1989 that there was transformer damage all across North America. But the thing is that the really big transformers at power substations,
right,
we don't produce a lot of those.
No, there's only a few. We only have like one or two, like for backup, don't we?
I think it's a bit more than that, but, you know, 10, 15 a year, I think, is what U.S. industry produces. And so there might be a few, you know, in transit or in backup, but, boy, if you lost, you know, 40 or 50 of those, then what are you going to do?
You're out of luck. That's right.
Yeah, there are going to be parts of the country that could be without electrical power for a really long period of time. And this NRC report pointed out it could be, in some places, months before electrical power was restored. Now, anybody who's been through a power outage of even just a few days.
How about an hour?
yeah, but just a few days, you know what that means. I mean, it's really horrible. If you all your food and your freezer goes bad. Again, you know, when I lived in Florida, when the hurricanes would come through, you got to clear out your freezer, because if you lose power and you lose it for several days, you're going to have a rotting mess in your freezer.
No question. Stay with us, Dr. Ramon Lopez. 2 hours. We'll take phone calls next hour. We'll talk about radiation. We'll be back. Dr. Ramon Lopez with us. Ramon, we're constantly being bombarded from space with radiation. How intense is it?
Well, the cosmic rays that fill all of space, if you were out without any protection, they'd kill you. Not immediately, but over, you know, a period of time, the radiation levels would kill you. What protects us here on Earth are two things. First of all, there's our magnetic field, which exerts forces on these fast-moving charged particles, pushes them away. And the other thing is our atmosphere that absorbs a lot of the radiation. And if you want to protect yourself from radiation, the easiest way to do it is to put a lot of material between you and the radiation. And the radiation will be slowed and stopped and absorbed by that material. But this is a problem for astronauts who go into interplanetary space. There's all talk about, let's go to Mars and explore Mars with people. Well, the real difficulty is keeping those people alive because of the background cosmic radiation in space.
This possibility of the radiation and, you know, the ozone layer, is the ozone layer replenishing itself or is it still withering away?
Not really my area, but the last thing that I read in sort of the popular science press is that it was replenishing itself.
What do you see, Dr. Lopez, as our biggest pressing issue with space weather?
The biggest pressing issue is adequate prediction. Because as we, you know, we're heading into another solar maximum every 11 or so years, the number of sunspots goes up and down. When the number of sunspots is high, that's when we have a lot of these solar flares and coronal mass ejections. And we're heading into another solar maximum. So having good prediction is important. You know, every solar cycle, humans are getting more and more dependent not only on space technology, but our technology here on the ground is getting interlinked, interdependent, all of our power grids. And that just means we're more and more vulnerable to changes in the space environment. So prediction is key. But as Yogi Berra said, prediction is hard, especially about the future.
That's true. Can you imagine if people had to go one day without their cell phones where they couldn't text message people or go on and do their social networking? They'd go crazy.
They would.
And it's very, very possible. Let's talk a little bit about sunspots. First of all, you know, about a year or so ago, I think we went through a spell where we almost didn't have any, almost the whole year. And then now they seem to be cropping up again. What are sunspots? What causes sunspots?
Sunspots are tubes of magnetic field that get twisted up underneath the surface. And then the magnetic field, it has a pressure of its own, so it squeezes out some of the plasma, the hot electrically conducting gas that makes up the sun. And because there's less plasma in there, they get buoyant. They float up. Then they'll pop up through the surface. And because they squeeze some of the gas out, there's not as much light coming from the region of the high magnetic field. And so it looks dark in comparison to the neighboring areas. We call that a sunspot. They're not really dark. They're just a little bit less light, less brilliant than the surrounding areas.
And a little cooler.
And a little cooler. So in comparison, they look a little bit dark. But they're an indicator of how much solar magnetic field there is, how much solar magnetic activity there is. And number of sunspots goes up and down with this regular cycle. But it's not always regular. There was a period in the 1600s known as the Maunder Minimum when sunspots pretty much went away. And in the 1800s, there was a period called the Dalton Minimum, where for a couple of cycles, magnetic activity was very, very low. Now, as you pointed out, a few years ago, we had the longest, deepest solar minimum we ever had on record in the scientific era. And there are a lot of people, that myself included, that believe that either we're going into a Dalton Minimum or maybe even a Maunder Minimum, a long-term, you know, 60 to 80-year minimum in solar activity.
Can you get physically hurt from a coronal mass ejection? If you're standing outside and we finally get zapped with an X10, Can that person physically be hurt?
No.
Okay.
No. These you know, there's a huge amount of energy in these things. It's spread out over an enormous area of space, and so you don't really, you know, in any one spot, there's not a lot of energy that's deposited. Just that they're really, really big, and there's a lot of energy involved when you add it all up. But in a single spot, so you know, humans would never know the difference if it wasn't for our technology.
Okay, when we look at these episodes, and when we get these coronal mass ejections, we get these northern lights. What causes that exactly when on the planet?
As the solar wind streams past the Earth's magnetic field, it acts like a big generator. And some of the energy of that flow gets captured by the Earth's magnetic field, and that generates electric currents inside the region dominated by the Earth's magnetic field. Some of those electric currents will flow down into the polar region. And if the current is strong enough, then it'll cause the upper atmosphere to light up in the same way that when you put electric current through your neon tube, the neon tube will light up, but only if the current is strong enough to cause the effect. So that's what we're seeing. We're seeing these electric currents that are generated by the solar wind, and they're always there. The problem is that when you have a huge gust of solar wind in one of these big magnetic clouds, the level of magnetic activity can jump up, the amount of current that's flowing through the whole system can jump up, and then it's those huge currents that are flowing through our ionosphere that have effect on our technology. They can affect our power grid system here on Earth. They can really affect GPS. This is a huge, huge thing for space weather prediction. People don't realize how dependent we are economically on GPS. You know, you read about all of this new oil drilling technology where they're drilling horizontally through shallow layers and everything. How do they guide those drill bits? It's with GPS. Farmers now, they program tractors to deposit seed and fertilizer and insecticide and other products. They program them by GPS, and then the tractor does
its thing.
This stuff. We are
airplanes.
Yeah, airplanes. Just it's not just something that you have to make sure you're not lost driving around. It's a huge economic impact. So right now, the number one priority for Space Weather Prediction Center is to have good prediction of natural denial of lock from GPS.
Okay, if you were doing what you do, and you knew an X-15 was coming this way, what would you say on this radio show before it hit here?
If you live in Michigan, go out and take a look at the night sky. You know, see if you see aurora. You know, if you're taking a plane flight from Chicago to Beijing, watch out. Your plane flight will probably be delayed because airlines don't like to fly through the polar regions when there's a big storm going on, and so they divert aircraft and cancel flights. Stuff like this. Whenever I take a flight, I just came back from a scientific conference in Singapore, you know, and I did these polar routes, like Chicago to Hong Kong, fly over the pole. So I always take a look at the space weather. Just, you know, there's nothing I can do about it, but at least I can be prepared if something's coming.
Ramon, I've got to ask you this about the flips. When this planet has its pole flips and it's moving now, how much has it changed?
Well, Earth's magnetic field has been changing actually pretty rapidly in the last couple of decades. The magnetic pole is wandering at speeds that are pretty high by historical standards, and the Earth's dipole moment gets weaker. What happens is the Earth's magnetic field weakens, and sort of the main component, which is like that of a bar magnet, it goes through zero and it reverses and it strengthens again. And this process takes several thousand years, and it happens regularly. We know this by looking at the spreading of the seafloor, so the different directions of the magnetic field get locked in to the seafloor as the magma comes out, it cools, it locks in sort of like a compass needle freezing in a particular direction.
Is it going to be a total flip?
Yeah, this happens regularly. It happens on the sun, too, but on the sun it happens every 22 years. On the Earth it happens more like every, 250,000 years. And why it happens, we're not really sure exactly the details of why the Earth's magnetic field flips. But it's not really something that affects life here on Earth. I know that there have been attempts to look to see if there are mass extinctions for example.
Right, or do birds smash into walls?
Right,
things
and,
like
and there doesn't seem to be any evidence that it has a huge impact on life here on Earth. I mean, remember that what's protecting us from the cosmic radiation is two things, the magnetic field and the atmosphere. So the magnetic field gets weak and then for a few thousand years goes through zero. You're going to have higher levels of radiation here on Earth, but, you know, it's not a whole lot of difference than being here in Dallas, which is not too far off the sea level, and being up in Denver, Colorado. You know, when you're up a mile up, you've given up a lot of the atmosphere protection. And so radiation levels in Denver from cosmic rays are significantly higher than they are here in Dallas. But in both cases, it's not enough to be a major health threat.
Are physical scientists, Doctor, concerned about CMEs and other possible space weather anomalies?
Well, we're concerned because a really big one can have a really significant impact on our civilization. It can, especially in North America, because of the geology and how
sure.
it works. That our power grid in North America is more vulnerable than other places. So you want to be aware of what are the potential risks. That's why this report in 2008 from the National Academy of Sciences said, what's the worst possible thing that can happen? And you just want to be prepared for those risks. There's a lot of scary stuff out there. There's potential asteroid impact.
Oh, sure.
There's a Yellowstone supervolcano that one of these days will go off. It's not going to happen.
It's overdue.
It's not likely to happen on any given day, but, you know, these things happen. And you just want to be prepared and understand what are the potential impacts of catastrophic events.
When a CME hits, how long does it continue coming?
Biggest part of the magnetic storm lasts anywhere from a few hours to maybe a day.
Okay. So generally, if the side of the planet is facing the sun and they get hit initially, what about the people that are on the other side?
Well, it's global. Actually, the people on the night side get more of the electric current coming through the ionosphere.
They will.
But okay. What happens is the energy gets processed through the magnetic tail of the Earth. It points away from the sun, and that energy comes back up the magnetic tail. So you see the big auroras and things like that actually on the night side.
So what you're saying is the whole planet's up a creek.
Yeah, the whole planet gets a... I mean, that was the whole idea of a magnetic storm, is in the 1800s, people, as they set up magnetic observatories around the world, they realized, hey, wait a second, the whole magnetic field of the Earth is getting shaken
yeah.
from time to time. What could be doing that?
So the entire planet could go dark during a big enough coronal mass ejection?
Probably not, because whether your power grid goes down depends in part on the geology of where you are, because that determines how much electric current is flowing in the ground and whether it's going to get diverted into your power grid system.
What about some of these third world nations? We saw what happened, by the way, to India just several weeks ago when they had a little mishap with their power grid.
Yeah. Now, actually, if you're near the equator, you're less vulnerable.
Less
vulnerable to the power grid distortion. But on the other hand, you know, if your electrical grid system is already kind of shaky, might not take much to push it over.
Would that be an opportune time for another country that might have more juice, more power, to take some offense against another?
People try to take advantage of all kinds of situations. I think that they might want to take advantage of it monetarily rather than militarily.
Well,
you've got something somebody else doesn't have, you can charge a premium for it.
Tell me about your work, Storms from the Sun. Where's the book available?
The book right now is out of print, although you can find it on Amazon.com, and there are lots of copies floating around. But actually, anybody who wants to read it can get it for free by going to the National Academy Press.
Did you say free?
For free. You can download it as a free PDF. Since we knew that we weren't going to have another edition printed, Mike Karlowitz, my co-author, he's a science journalist, we decided, hey, let's just make this available for free for anybody who's interested in the topic. So all that a listener would have to do is, you know, open up their web browser and Google Storms from the Sun, and then look for the link that goes to National Academy Press. click on that particular link, it'll take you to the National Academy Press webpage, and then you can download the whole thing for free as a PDF. You can put it into your Kindle or whatever, and it's a fun read.
Now, do you personally do anything? Are you prepared in case something happens?
Oh, I'm prepared for all kinds of emergencies. You know, like many people, I used to live in Florida, right?
Yeah.
We have hurricanes. So I've got
all the
radio
time.
that's a wind-up radio.
Okay.
Right? So that
we recommend
power
this.
Goes out.
We've got our CC Solar Observer, which has got it all, the solar panel, the works.
Yeah, and I've got LED flashlights that are plugged into the wall, so they're always charged, and they last a long time. And it's always good to have a little bit of spare food and water around in case, you know, your systems go down. And one thing I haven't done is I haven't gotten, like, a generator or
something
like that. But
the problem is we can't predict how long, right? Whether your water should last a week or a month, we don't know this, do we?
No, we don't know. And, you know, space weather is just one of many possible things out there that can cause catastrophic events. And on the one hand, people shouldn't obsess about potential catastrophes. You know, you shouldn't be worried that Yellowstone is going to blow up, or that we're going to get slammed by an asteroid, or coronal mass ejection is going to crash our technology. On the other hand, it's prudent to be aware of these things and to, always have a little bit of preparation in case your water doesn't work for a couple of days.
My science teacher, when I was a kid, once told us about the life of the sun. And he said, it was Mr. Strom, I'll always remember the guy. He said, the sun eventually is going to die out and everything will be gone. And I got to tell you, Ramon, for weeks, I couldn't sleep. I go home and I tell my parents, they said, it's over for us. The sun's going to burn out and that's it. And my dad said, well, how long did he say? And I said, well, he said in billions of years. And he said, George, do you have any idea how long that is from now? And it just, I didn't comprehend it. All I knew was the sun was going to die out and we were toast. And, it's a bizarre factor. We have a story up on the Coast to Coast website of a star eating a planet. I guess that's the way we're going to go one day, isn't it?
That's the way Earth will go. Whether that's the way we go, that's a different story.
Yeah, we could go much sooner than that.
We could go much sooner, or at that point, you know, we could be all over the galaxy, and the loss of one planet wouldn't mean too much to us.
Do we ever get hit by rays from supernovas that have exploded millions and billions of miles away?
Yes, that's what cosmic rays are. They're produced, at least most of them are produced in supernova explosions. The very highest energy stuff, we still don't have any real clue as how the highest energy cosmic rays are produced.
Can they harm us?
Yeah, if you get a whole bunch of them. But again, here on the surface of the Earth, we're protected by our magnetic field and by our atmosphere. If you were, say, exploring the surface of Mars, that would be a different story. You would be getting a pretty healthy cosmic ray dose day in, day out.
Uh-huh.
And eventually that would kill you.
Could we harness the power of something like that?
No, because, again, it's so thin. You know, like the aurora, there's millions of amps of electric current that flows through the aurora, but to collect that,
yeah,
you have to cover Alaska with copper wires, copper mesh. I mean, that's simply just not.
It's not going to happen. Ramon, stay with us. Final hour to go with you. We're going to take phone calls next as we talk about storms from the sun. I'm George Norrie. If you need to email me, George@coasttocoastam.com. We will be right back.